Welcome back. We have some breaking news now. After criticism over his recent cabinet picks from Kentucky Senator Rand Paul, President Donald Trump has called a press conference announcing that Paul, his fellow Republican and one-time rival, is, quote, little homie gay ass. Here's a clip from that presser a few moments ago.
Okay, look, we've gotten a lot done in the last month of this office, okay? How many great things have we gotten done? But listen, I say this all the time, and now I'm saying it to you. Rand, he is little homie gay ass. Republican or Democrat, they say Rand is a little homie gay ass.
Senator Paul is delivering his own rebuke to the president outside of Capitol Hill. We have a reporter there on the scene.
Once again, Donald Trump has shown the kind of man that he is. To officially decree anyone as the little homie gay ass is one thing. It would be unacceptable if it was just Donald Trump, the private citizen, declaring it. But for the President of the United States not just to call a sitting U.S. Senator little homie gay ass, but to say it specifically about somebody who has defended the Constitution times and times again. And, you know, he took an oath. He took an oath in there to defend the Constitution. And if he had read that document instead of watching TV or tweeting, he would know that in order to call somebody little homie gay ass, to officially decree it under the powers of the federal government, you need a letter of marque signed off by three judges and three-fourths of the state legislatures in the union declaring me to be little homie gay ass. So I say to you this to you, President Trump. If you want to call me little homie gay ass, well, to me, I'm little homie defend the Constitution ass. And you can decree that.
The president hasn't yet responded to Paul's new line of attack. He is busy this morning signing a new bill into law that will make it legal for mailmen to kill dogs without repercussion. We're joined now by journalist Shane Bauer, who I gotta say, thank you for joining us on this snow day and making it out to be here with us. And also, congratulations on winning Best Magazine in America.
Thanks.
You're cleaning up. Here.
Yeah, Shane, for people who don't know, Shane just won the Source Awards. That's what he won. That's what that award is called.
It's appropriate because I'm basically bankrolled by him. No, I'm not actually.
What, Benzino?
Shane's first article was an expose about how Eminem only deserved two mics.
Shane, I mean, there's a lot of stuff that we can talk to you about, but I just want to begin right off the bat. The inauguration just happened, So I want to ask you, and I think our listeners want to know, what was it like? You know, January 20th, 1981, Reagan has been inaugurated. You've just been freed from Iran. You come home again after your 444 long day ordeal. What was that like? How did you feel stepping off that airplane?
It felt good, although it was in 2011
what?
Rather than 1981.
Yeah. God damn it, Will.
Well.
You fucked up again. You got the fucking research wrong again.
Well, oh my God.
But how grateful did you feel to President Reagan?
Well, this is not a good look right now.
No, seriously though, you're based in Berkeley, right?
Oakland.
Yep. Okay, I want to get your impressions because you have a pretty unique perspective, both as a journalist and for other reasons on. All the protests that have happened since the inauguration in like the first couple weeks of the Trump administration, and in particular, I know I saw that you were tweeting from Berkeley with the Milo event and the sort of all of the Suris that went down there. So just to begin, I mean, what did you see there, and what were your impressions of what went down in Berkeley?
I mean, I think the protests generally have been really interesting and different. I mean, I think, you know, there's been this huge range. There's been, like, you know, the inauguration protests, there's the Women's March, there's the airport stuff, then there's this kind of round of Milo protests, anti-Milo protests around the country, and they've all been really different. I was at all of them, the airport one, because I happened to be flying into the airport. And what was interesting to me about the Milo protests, one was that I've never seen anything like that in the East Bay. I've been there for about 20 years. At least that scale of kind of, you know, I guess for lack of a better term, kind of militant street protest. There was, you know, fires, there was a lot of vandalism. But that's not really what was unique, because that happens in Oakland all the time. Basically, if I'm at my house and there's like a helicopter flying, I ride my bike downtown and there's a riot, you know. But a lot of times it's like kind of a small clique of people. They're kind of doing the same thing. And what was unique about this was that there were maybe 1,500 people, maybe 2,000, maybe 150 of them were actually, you know, kind of breaking new buildings, hitting fires. But all the other people didn't take off when that happened, which is normally what would have happened in the past, I think. And the police start shooting rubber bullets at people, and people didn't go away. And I think there was kind of a sense of people, you know, being on the same page more than had been before. Not completely. I mean, there was, you know, conflict happening within. There were some shitty things that happened. You know, a woman got pepper sprayed. People got mistakenly identified as white supremacists. I think there was a Muslim that got beat down. You know, there was, it was, you know, it was intense. People were really pretty keyed up, and there were a couple times I thought I was going to break out into fights.
But, like,
fights.
The majority of people, it seems you're saying, like, rather than be sort of, like, not countenancing, like, the more dangerous stuff, were sort of not participating in it, but not right. fleeing either. Not,
right.
They were yeah. willing to just stick it out, basically.
Yeah, the whole kind of, like, vibe of the situation was, even before it started, was different. Like, I happened to get up there earlier, and I just, like, went to a cafe and was just, like, reading for a little bit. And I heard somebody, like, you know, walking by, like, an ACLU canvasser, and he was like, "Are you going to punch a Nazi today?" And the ACLU guy was like, "No." And the other guy was like, "I am." And the ACLU guy was like, "All right. And I'm a Jew." it was like that kind of stuff is, like, you know, it's just a different scene. It's just a different situation that we're in now. And it seems that there's more of a sense of that a lot of people have that these kind of figures like Milo or Richard Spencer have to be just stopped and not just kind of spoken out against. I think the reaction since then has been interesting. There's been the kind of narrative of, you know, don't feed into Milo's hand or Trump's hand, which I think is a kind of losing strategy, because everything feeds into Trump's hand. Every mm-hmm. protest feeds into,
yeah.
he can, you know, the Women's March was showing that, you know, Democrats and the left, the whole spectrum of the left, is anti-democratic. The airport protests were showing that the left loves terrorists. Black Lives Matter is racist. You know, it's like all this stuff can be spun, but the point of these things is not to stick Trump in a place where he has nothing to argue anymore.
Right.
Right. I mean, like, all these, like, dumb things that I see, it's always a Medium article where it's like, you know, by protesting, you're actually playing into Trump's hand, because this is a trial balloon. I know, because I've seen the show Mr. Robot. Like,
right.
Fucking bullshit like that. It's, like, always from tech people who don't have an understanding of politics as the execution of power and the, you know, a coalition of wills and ideas. They think it is a TV show, and they think it is, like, a fucking inner tech company power struggle. And they also believe in this logic dork shit where it's like, well, if we actually stop doing all the bad stuff, then Trump can't say that he made America great again.
Right.
And it's like, what the fuck are you talking about? Have you seen any political process in any country fucking ever?
Yeah, the idea that, like, ignoring whatever, hate, is, like, makes it go away has never, ever happened. You know?
Never.
Never.
You know, well, like, I mean, I understand people want to feel like they're stopping these guys, but I got to say, I think that all of this stuff is very counterproductive. I think the only thing to be done is to go to Nordstrom's and buy as many pantsuits as you can. I'm currently wearing four pantsuits. I'm sitting on a throne of Budweiser that I purchased. And I have a entire backyard full of that lumber from that company from the Super Bowl. I don't know what I'm going to do with it yet. Maybe just build a giant statue of Keith Olbermann or something. I don't know.
I mean, imagine, if you will, that Hillary had won the election, that she is the 45th president. I think she'd be at Nordstrom's right now with Huma Abedin or something, drunk off her ass on Budweiser and texting unfrowny faces to Mitch McConnell.
Yeah. I mean, I've been reading that account, and you know, it has 100% less vomiting and fainting than would happen in the real life.
I love that Hillary. It also inspired a Tim Kaine fake account about fake Vice President Tim Kaine.
You should, if you start an account where you're fantasizing about what Tim Kaine would do in an alternate timeline, Twitter should immediately send suicide prevention to your ass. Like, you should immediately get 5150.
Yeah, no. And the funniest thing, though, is that all of those things, all the fantasy, it's like these people are creating a fantasy. They're trying to create a world without Donald Trump as president, and yet every single one is a direct response to this real world. Like, it's totally like their world is controlled by Trump at every level, because they're like, I'm going to hang up the Coretta Scott King letter, and I'm going to tell Jeff Sessions, oh, hell. It's like, you would be nominating Jeff Sessions to the Attorney General if you'd won? And it's like, their whole, even their fantasy lives are controlled by Trump. It's a nightmare.
What amazes me too is like how the now that the Democrats aren't in power, there's kind of this it's just become so easy for kind of mainstream liberals to come up with conspiracies, share them. Like the Berkeley thing, there was Robert Reich had this thing where like all of the people that were, you know, riding were actually Breitbart employees, and he said you know, he didn't recognize any of them, but they happened to all be wearing masks,
right? And like I think this is like the broader point about, you know, these people trying to sort of, you know, game out and strategize about these protests and this idea of like, oh, you know, this is actually Trump's genius plan or whatever, right? And I just think, like, yes, like as Matt said, Trump is living in all our heads right now, because the reality is he's in control of the government, and there's very little we can do about that. But like, let's say he is, the protests are playing into his master plan. I don't think that should alter the moral necessity to protest this, if that's what you believe in. Because I just think like people need to get out of their heads and stop being so neurotic about this.
Oh, yeah. The neurosis thing is totally.
Like, and just like do the right thing, or do what you believe in.
People are so wedded to from rooting on Obama for 8 years from the sidelines and all of his 12th dimensional chess and all that shit. They're in this mode of thinking at a grand strategy level, like they're in, you know, like a war room, you know, and they're pointing out what to do, and like, oh, we're going to beat Trump with this strategy. But they don't realize is that like his election is creating a crisis that's exploding energy outward everywhere, and there's no controlling it. Like, people are going to tisk tisk black block and whatever happened in Berkeley, and they probably did some shit that was not terribly productive, but like, are you going to tell them? Like, they're not going to listen to you even if you scold them.
Oh, no.
They have energy and they want to put it out, but other people want to do other things. And it seems to me that everybody's first instinct shouldn't be to scold somebody else for thinking and then doing something wrong. It's to think, what do you think is the right strategy?
Right, and carry
that forward. And everyone's going to have different ideas, and everyone should focus on what they think is most effective, because a multiplicity of strategies and energies.
And that's
going
what there's been.
Directions.
I mean, all of these things have been so different really powerful in different ways. I mean, you know, the Women's March in Oakland was like just like, I don't know how many tens of thousands of people just like carrying signs. But it was like a massive number of people, you know? I mean, that said a certain thing. This thing at Berkeley said a different thing, and it's all kind of part of this tapestry.
You do need a diversity of tactics, because this is a huge country where there's a huge amount of people that believe a huge amount of different shit. You know, it's amazing. Like, I love it when people, like, you know, complain about the anarchists and they're like, oh, they're smashing up the town that voted for, you know, that went for Hillary by 80%. Like, yeah, anarchists love Hillary, dude. But anyway, I think that this mindset that a lot of the liberal commentariat has gotten into, where everything plays into Trump's hand. It's, you know, it's all a trial balloon, and they're playing 12th dimensional chess. The overestimation of Trump and Bannon, it's, you could only think that if your previous thing was that, you know, what Hillary actually did have a great campaign. She actually did have a great ground game. She was only failed. She didn't fail anyone. She didn't, her campaign didn't fuck up in any way. So the only thing that could beat that would be the most brilliant political tacticians in history and a groundswell of Nazism. Neither of which are the case. I mean, yes, Steve Bannon has read The Art of War, and I'm aware that in fucking D.C. that makes you a genius, even though 90% of the shit in that book is like, try to get the sun in your enemy's eyes. But
it's like Sun Tzu says, a war commander is benevolent and unconcerned with fame.
What?
Sun Tzu, the Chinese Prince Machiavelli. Tony Tamiyato. Zhu. Zhu.
Sun Tzu, you fucking ass
kid. He's just a fucking obese rich guy at the end of the day who's read a few fucking books. He isn't reading your fucking mind. He is if you put him in your mind and think that every single thing you do relates to one of his actions. But at the end of the day, he's just a guy, and Trump's just a fucking guy, and this is just fucking politics.
Well, I mean, these people, they're just trading in one insane fantasia for another. They spent 8 years convinced that Obama... coup, his brilliant 12th dimensional chess coup was right around the corner. That, like, every time he was getting his shit kicked in by the GOP nonstop, not getting a thing done, not confirming a Supreme Court justice for a vacancy that was open for almost a year, not accomplishing anything domestically or foreign policy for years, they were insisting, no, just wait, it's coming. He's setting up these pins. You don't see it. And then he left, and they have still not processed that, oh, he wasn't doing that. And now they've just transferred that fantasy onto Trump.
It's also a fantasy about Obama that in some way exculpates themselves for supporting someone who does nakedly bad things. And it reminds me of this tweet. It was some liberal, like, Think Progress type pundit who said, Obama, in his heart, is a good person. He doesn't want to do the drone strikes, but he has. They make him do it.
The funniest one of those, this was, I think, from the movie Bob, who is one of the sad
love that guy.
Who love comic books and cartoons and video games, but then also decide that they're political master geniuses, who remember when there was that really gross New York Times piece about the kill list and the signature strikes that had the quote of Obama saying, I'm really good at killing people. He said, that's bad. And this was before 2012. He's like, but he's up for re-election, and he might think that some of the more war-happy people in America are going to read that, and they're going to be more likely to vote for him because they said that he likes to kill people. Like, how much glue do you have to huff to think at that level to try to, like, justify just heinous callousness?
King Leopold, by cutting off people's arms, he's actually he's watching out for his right flank. He's triangulating.
To get back to, like, the protests and, like, the larger response to Trump, I was wondering, like, Shane, of anything that you've covered or seen nationally that excites or interests you, that you think is something new or different as opposed to a lot of the energy or activism that took place during the Bush administration?
I mean, I think that what seems new to me is that the country just polarizing like crazy. And these protests, a lot of them, you know, there's the kind of black bloc anti-fascist type, the people that call themselves that. But that kind of sentiment of this, like, freak out that we're entering this kind of fascist era, I think is, like, a pretty common theme. And I feel like a lot of people are moving, you know, either people are moving right and left in all directions, you know, and that seems to come through to me in these protests.
Mm-hmm. And like, for instance, last week, we went to two protests. Brendan and I went to this one in front of Chuck Schumer's house on Prospect Park West, which was really cool. It got like 3,000 people came out there.
Did anyone yell "Cuck Schumer" at him?
No, but I tried to get a good chant going of Chucky, Chucky. And, like, some of that, a lot of the chants were like Senator Schumer, grow a spine. Now it's time to, you know, sing this time or something. And I just thought, well, that's expecting a little too much of Chuck Schumer. So I'd prefer to just do the Daryl, just chant at his window. For all I know, he wasn't even home. But if his neighbors in the co-op board get pissed off, I think that's a better pressure point than most forms of popular protest. Yeah. And then on Thursday, actually, was even more amazing, was the Yemeni bodega strike that happened here in New York City. Yemen, as we all know, is one of the seven countries on this block banned list that just came out of the Trump administration. And probably 2,000 bodega workers just were mad deep in front of Borough Hall, which is like the original Brooklyn City Hall. And I was blown away by it. And like for these guys, like the bodega workers, like that's a precarious existence. They live like minute to minute, like, I mean, paycheck to paycheck was like, that's soft selling it.
Yeah.
Like that, like they like to take off like half a day for them is a big deal. And there was a really, really big and impressive turnout.
Yemenis are really good at that though. I lived in Yemen for like a year and a half. And I remember there was like a minor tax increase and the shopkeepers across the whole country like went on strike. You know, it's like, you know, I think there's people talking about a general strike in the U.S. It doesn't work here, you know? It's everybody is like kind of internalized this idea of individualized protest, like what eggs you buy, kind of, you know, whether you buy organic or not. But Yemen, they have it.
Shane, did you ever see the, it was after the triple tap in Sana'a when the Saudis hit like one position, then the hospital and the funeral? A million people came out to fucking protest in Sana'a, and Saudi jets were fucking strafing them, and they were still out there. Like, I guess we need some Houthi organizers, is what I'm saying.
Do you have a? I mean, do you have an opinion though on like a lot of, you know, on the idea of a general strike, or would that be effective in the current American climate and culture? Do you think?
I mean, I guess on the one hand, you can't really say like this thing has never happened before, so it's not going to work because that's not the world we live in anymore in this country. But yeah, I mean, I've seen like attempts at general strikes, even just in a city like Oakland. It's still like a tiny, you know, minority, even though it could be like a big march or something that comes out of it. But yeah, I mean, the idea of like you know, a significant portion of the population going on strike, it's hard to imagine to me.
I mean, I think that part of the thing that trips people up and makes them worried about it is the term, because they feel like it's promising more than they can deliver.
Totally.
You know, they're like hoping like the, you know, like when they overthrew the Kapp-Putsch, you know, in 1919 or whatever. And I think like if you called it something else, like just like a one day, you don't go to work, you go in the streets, you know. Work like or so like the model sort of would be the moratorium in 1969, which was a nationwide one day walkout basically to protest Vietnam, and it was massively successful. It was like millions of people, and if you know they'd called it a general strike, it would go on the list with all the sad failed general strikes to come before it.
Right,
and I think that that might be true here, because I think like I mean obviously people are going to have to stay in the habit of agitating and organizing and being out, and so there's going to have to be periodical like mass protests, like Women's March modeled mass demonstrations to keep people, to keep the muscles, you know, up.
I just think like to this broader point about protests and strategy and things like that, I think it's just, you know, frankly most of us didn't think this would be like a situation we'd find ourselves in our adult lives really considering. But I just think like nobody can really know what will be important or effective in the future. So cast a wide net and just do what you believe in. And just like,
I think that like, I mean, maybe not a general strike, but like in industry specific, like organized, like labor spaces.
Well, like that's what impressed me about spaces, the bodega.
Exactly.
Yeah. Like people denying, use bodegas. Yeah, exactly. They're just all of a sudden they're like,
or
gone.
The cabs during the JFK thing.
Yeah.
Like that's, that is something that like on a, on more local and a more like industry specific model, because most people in America aren't in a union, they can get fired for not coming in.
Yeah.
But like places where there is unions, where there is that sort of collective power, like they need to like get beyond narrow, you know, issues of pay and stuff like that, because like they're coming for them hardcore. Like national right to work is on the agenda.
Yeah.
If they can pass that. So like I think that that's going to be very important. But of course, you know, most people listening to this are not in a union because there's barely anybody in the union anymore.
To change directions, slightly. I do want to talk to you, Shane, about one of your most recent investigative pieces. Mm-hmm. You know that you're racking up all these bloody magazine awards for. Yeah, for those of you who don't know, Shane, you know, for Mother Jones, he does these sort of like hidden camera undercover pranks and spoofs.
I basically just splice video together to make it look like you know, like
haunted house sort of spoofs and elevators and things like that. Yeah, you like scare people.
Abortion doctors are selling.
Yeah, sort of a ripoff of James O'Keefe.
No, but I want to ask about the thing you did where you. You joined this, paramilitary border militia. Yeah. The 3% United Patriots Militia.
Those sound like good dudes.
This is my favorite detail. For, quote, Operation Spring Break. And, Brendan, can you just edit in the James Franco going, Spring Break. Spring Break.
Spring Break.
But Shane, first of all, could you explain who the 3% United Patriots militia was, how you joined them, and just like what that scene is like?
Yeah, so 3% United Patriots are a national militia. This is a phenomenon that started kind of after Obama was elected. You know, the militia movement started in the 90s and kind of died down after Bush was elected, and then Obama became president, and it skyrocketed. And in the 90s, they had been kind of localized militias, kind of county-based. And then after Obama, there were some statewide militias. California has one. Arizona has one that have kind of battalions across the state and things like that. And then there's groups like 3% United Patriots that are kind of more nationally organized. And they're also a little bit different. They're part of this kind of larger movement called the 3%er movement. And
what is that? What does that 3% refer to?
The idea.
It's the type of milk they drink. They add extra fat to the 2% because they're that manly.
Well, you mix 2% and 1%.
That's what I said.
It's based on the belief that 3% of the American population was responsible for overthrowing the British in 1776, which
New York City.
Which is a belief that historians say is specious, but that kind of really doesn't matter. These guys, so they're basically the paramilitary wing of this kind of larger movement. And the movement is, it's just kind of based around a Luciite kind of just patriot movement ideas, this fundamentalist belief in the Constitution, hatred for the federal government, although I would imagine that's probably changed in the last few weeks. So this group, their main core is in Colorado. They also have branches across the country. And I basically, like, you know, just kind of poking around in the militia movement, I started a Facebook page and just like followed a bunch of militia groups and then just sent blanket friend requests to everybody following them. And then like within a couple of days, I had like 200 militia friends, and I would just repost posts that they would put up.
Can you give us an idea? What are their memes like?
It's like,
what are the Facebook militia memes?
You know, Syrian crosses the border because Obama has declared Sharia law, you know, that kind of stuff. And I would just repost that stuff, you know, to keep my page active.
There's a guy in a turban and it says, I can has Sharia.
We could have, like, I wish you had told us while you were doing it, because we would have made some memes for you. Like, it would have been a guy in a cardboard box with his beard sticking out. And it would be like, it may not look it, but a man going through the border right now.
We're kind of like a militia, but for posting.
Yeah. I mean, more than, we're more like Hezbollah for posting, or an army.
Of course, Felix.
Yeah.
So. But, So you created this kind of this Facebook presence, and then how did you actually go about like joining this group and going on one of these patrols? They're based out of Colorado, but then they go down to the border. And like what do they do?
Well, so before I went to the border, I actually joined some California militias, just kind of like get my foot in the water, and I figured I could stay home, go off like into the woods on the weekends. And so I joined the California State Militia. I also joined a militia called the 31st Defense Legion. Called myself Rattlesnake.
Call me Snake.
And it was a kind of hilarious scene in some ways. There was one time, so I met with this 31st Defense Legion, which is a breakaway group from the you know, the California State Militia, and I met with this guy in like a Starbucks in Target in San Rafael, and we're like sitting in the corner, he's talking to me in low tones, and he's just like, you know, the California State Militia, they're a bunch of pussies. We're like the ones that, you know, we're really the hardcore. We have a brotherhood. And I was like, all right, I'm in. So I like went off to this like place in far Northern California for a weekend training. And it's like 15 of us. And we get out of the truck and this guy's like, okay, everybody, 31st Defense Legion protocol is now in effect. If you have a question, you need to ask the officer that ranks immediately above you. And we're like standing in a circle of like 10 or 15 people, and there's like 8 or 9 ranks among those people. And then we're just like doing like, we're running through the water across rivers doing like these kind of,
so you
like,
do some like obstacle course stuff? Like,
yeah, basically. Yeah.
Trust falls?
No.
Monkey bars?
Did they have you do improv exercises?
This is the UCB militia.
Yeah. I need a place.
The border.
I need a job.
Terrorists.
So the whole time I kind of actually like I wanted to join this kind of national militia, the 3% United Patriots. And then I saw this thing on Facebook where they had a call out for a border operation. It was like a private page, and I just requested access, and they gave it to me immediately. And there was like a post. That,
great OPSEC.
There was a post that was like, who's coming down to the border? Post yes, if so. I just said yes. And then like they post the coordinates, and I just got a plane ticket.
Wait a minute. Wasn't there at least like, are you an investigative journalist? Check yes or no.
Was it like, you know, when somebody like throws a party on Facebook and like 2 days before the event, they're like, guys, the maybes are legitimately hurting my feelings.
I am gay, and I voted for Obama. I am a shill for the Clinton campaign and the left-wing mainstream press. I'm a pussy who gets fucked right up the ass. I am a cop, I am a leotard. I'm a fag who wants blacks to live amongst us. And Arabs to have equal rights. I have no love of country, white folks are all bad, but when the alt-right folks attack, it makes me sad. I am a cuck, I am a libtard. Don't talk of Trump, cause nothing scares. I really should call him daddy. He could be the savior and go down in history and save us all from douchebags just like me. I am a cuck, I am a libtard. And a cuck has no fun, and a libtard always cries.
Okay, so like the California training in the woods, and then like this other thing, like I guess like the each group has this sort of different flavor. But yeah. Like, what I want to know is like when you're hanging out with these guys and you're talking to them, like is it like, are they legitimately disturbing and scary people, or are they absent some odd or noxious political beliefs, like kind of just regular guys
or
who want to go hang out and like
internet nerds?
Yeah, like
it's kind of a mix of all of them. And I mean the guys in Arizona, they were pretty scary. I mean, you know, a lot of them were Afghan war vets, you know, and they're doing actual operations in the desert trying to find Mexicans. And you know, they have like assault rifles, they have, you know,
they're all armed, right?
And I really stood out because, you know, in California, you can only have a 10-round magazine. So, like, when I was in Arizona, they're like, what the fuck do you have that 10-round magazine for? And they have, like, not only 20-round magazines, but, like, 8 of them on their chest, you know?
Jesus.
So, you know, we're, like, rolling out, going to... on these like operations in the middle of the night in the daytime, and they're like amped up, you know, they're talking about hunting Mexicans. You know, they're it's kind of this weird mix of this kind of like, in some ways, a lot of them are really pathetic. Like, you know, we went on this operation with these two guys, and we're just like combing through the desert looking for people. And we're like walking, and this one guy is like points at the sand, and the other guy looks, and he's like looks up at him dramatically, and he's like, moccasin print. And the other guy is like, yep. And then they start, and I'm like looking, there's like nothing, it's just like waves in the sand, you know. So then they're like following this like these imaginary footprints, and I'm just like walking with them, and he finds like a cellophane wrapper on the ground, and he picks it up and like crumples it in his hand, and he like turns in another direction, he's like, that way, you know. And it's like, you know, it's like kind of a joke. It's like a video game, but they actually like are carrying assault rifles and are looking for people and like have war experience, you know?
Well, one of the things you write about in the article, like you mentioned that a lot of these guys are Iraq and Afghanistan veterans. And one of the things that really struck out to me is I think one of the guys you talked to talked about how this was like almost therapeutic for him.
Yeah.
Right? Like that to come back to America and kind of... it reminded him of what they were doing in Afghanistan and hanging out with guys with guns and this kind of almost play-acting war on American soil as a kind of therapy.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they see it as that kind of, you know, out in the middle of nowhere, Arizona is like the Wild West. It's like the frontier, and they're defending the frontier. They're protecting the country. They feel that kind of similar camaraderie as they did in the military. I heard a lot of people say that kind of stuff.
That you can't get in civilian life when you come home.
Yeah,
like they feel that that's lacking from their day-to-day experience.
And, you know, there's kind of a lot of them, too, that don't have military experience that are just kind of like, you know, suburban, alienated, working-class white guys that, like, you could imagine having gone in a totally different direction, but somehow this is the thing they fell into, and they felt some kind of sense of community and, you know, just went with that.
And sounds like they should have gamed.
They should have gained. So it's in some way like a primal scream therapy for these, you know, white men who, like a recurring theme in the article, economic anxiety, right?
Yeah.
You talk about this one guy who came back from Afghanistan, right? And he was working in a subway. He's got a child with a heart condition.
Totally.
And they're always bemoaning the state of Veterans Affairs. But I remember that paragraph clearly because it cuts from... what seems like a relatable gripe, and then goes right to why are blacks uppity now?
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
So how do you get from A to B?
No, so it's like a legitimate gripe, but then it's like, so we have to hunt Mexicans in the desert, or like, you know, and there's also this weird thing too where I think people mistakenly see these groups as like white supremacist groups, and you know. In a lot of ways, that's legit, but they don't see themselves that way. And they, you know, they think that, like, Black Lives Matter, the actual racists, you know, it's like...
All
anyone
lives
who's like,
matter,
yeah,
sir.
Exactly.
Except for Mexicans.
Or Muslim. Yeah, they had this thing where they would put, like, pork fat in all the food because they thought it would, like, keep out Muslim infiltrators.
That's so good. The way that they think that Muslims... react like vampires to garlic.
Yeah.
It's so good. It's hilarious.
But I think kind of the most incredible thing to me about that whole experience was seeing how the Border Patrol, the Federal Border Patrol.
You one of the things you run into an actual Border Patrol on a night patrol. And it was sort of like this slight moment of tension, but then like the Border Patrol guys are clearly like, hey, thanks for coming out here, man. I love what you guys do. You're doing my job for free. And that you know, I love you guys. Basically.
And he's like, you know, here's my card, contact me, I'll send you intel, you know. And I actually ended up, after I did that operation, I reached out to the head of the militia and interviewed him. And he was like, oh, yeah, we talk to them like every week. You know, when we like plan operations, we set it up with them, you know. They, you know, would tell us like where to go to find people. They would come to the camp and bring donuts, you know, that kind of stuff.
And, you know, you do talk about in the article, like, your fear of being out on one of these things and then actually coming across, like, an immigrant, someone trying to cross the border. I mean, like, what is there... what is their like stated protocol right. of that? Like, what do they actually do? What do they want to do? I mean, I know they're talking about like hunting Mexicans.
Right,
I mean, like, don't take that 100% literal. Like, they're just they're killing people. But
yeah,
like,
no,
but like,
idea.
It's weird though. Like, yeah, they are fully armed, and like, I think that they're afraid of like drug cartels. Like, that's why they have all this heavy weaponry or whatever.
Yeah,
but, like,
no, their whole thing is that they're hunting drug cartels. That's the narrative. But like, there were times that we're basically like riding around in this, like, I guess it was a state park or national park. In the back of a truck, like ISIS style, you know, like all these guys in camo.
Toyota-thon.
Like, and then we like, there was this one guy that was like, he was up on the top of a mountain doing watch. And he was talking about how he like had this like Mexican guy in his sights. And he was like, man, I wish I could have fucking picked this guy off.
Ooh,
if only our hands weren't tied, you know. But then he's like, he's talking about how
by the law against murder.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And he's like,
goddamn liberal judges.
And then he describes how one of the militia vehicles like rode through this little town, and he's watching it from the overwatch, and he sees this like Mexican looking guy run off. So to him, that's like, you know, that's evidence that that cartel runs this town, because this guy, because he's running from the militia, he's like a cartel operative, not just like, you know, some Mexican dude that's like, oh shit, I need to get out of here. There's like guys rolling through with guns, you know.
Yeah,
sir, I did not give you permission to run. Only a guilty man would run. I'm gonna need you to triangulate your position forthwith, upon which I'm the commander of this rock.
They came upon a bad
anyone who runs
once.
Is a drug cartel. Yeah, anyone who stands still is a well-paid drug cartel.
They came across a bat scientist once a few years ago.
A bat scientist?
Yeah. They like found these people walking, and they like, stop, you know, stay right there. And they're like yelling at this guy, and this guy is like freaked out. I saw some like, found some news accounts of it later, and he's, you know, hiding behind a rock, and they're like, don't move. And this guy's like, what the fuck is going on, you know? And he like sneaks back to his campsite, and they roll up on him, and they call the Border Patrol. The Border Patrol comes up, and turns out they're like counting bats in a cave or something.
Smuggling rabies into America.
sir, you do not have jurisdiction over bats. I have to check in with my commander to make sure that you are not referencing a mythical creature. Bats are associated with fictional characters like Dracula's. I think you're pulling my leg, and I will court-martial you.
But you talked in the beginning about how like these militia movements largely came up in the 90s, and then I cropped up again as a reaction to Obama.
Yeah.
And I want to ask, like, and you did allude to it earlier, like that they see themselves as fighting a kind of oppressive federal government.
Yeah.
Now it's a very different situation.
Right.
Like where are they going now that like basically their guy is in charge of the federal government who was elected on this their message more than anything else, secure the border.
Yeah.
So like, I mean, are they gonna, is it gonna tamp down, or are they just gonna become like more meshed together with the official workings of the state?
I'm not sure. And you know, I haven't been on top of them since he was elected, but I think the risk, you know, either some of them just kind of fade away, or there's some signaling that made me think that some of them will just kind of turn towards protesters, you know, because they had been doing that before. You know, there had been like the Oath Keepers patrolling Ferguson. You know, that's been a thing for a while. And they, you know, individually they come into this kind of movement for different reasons. But the through line is that they all believe that the world's going to fall apart at some point, and they need to get ready for it. And for a lot of them, you know, it's like, could be economic meltdown. It could have been Obama, you know, or the UN flying in and, you know, going door to door and taking everyone's guns.
Ebola. Remember when Ebola was going to do it? That was adorable.
Remember Jane Helm?
Or it could have been, or it could be Black Lives Matter, or, you know, civil unrest, which is like a thing that, you know, is still happening, that they could point to.
Well, I mean, what's going to happen is that Trump's going to be president, and their lives are still going to be shitty. And they're going to have to blame somebody.
Yeah.
And the people who are standing against him are going to be the easiest explanation and target.
And like,
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, go ahead, Virgil.
Okay, well, they're already paranoid, and that was like so. That was probably the more haunting theme throughout your piece was their paranoia that they're infiltrators, and it's all Muslims and Mexicans. Cartel guys are everywhere.
Right.
Like every fucking Mexican person they meet is like, oh yeah, definite cartel agent. And the most disturbing passage, and there were so many disturbing passages, I thought was when you were out on patrol with those two guys, and Felix, you like this detail? These guys are they were like childhood friends, right? They're from the same hometown, and but one of them outranks the other, and the other one calls him sir.
I mean something that like I don't know, it kind of reminds me of fight gyms. What a shock, it reminds me of one of the three things that I know about. What a shock that everything in the world goes back to you know, the only things that I've ever done or know about. But no, there is like combination of these two things that sort of happen when you're economically dislocated and you feel degraded every day and everything's fucked up all the time. It's A, you can't acknowledge the conspiracy in front of you that's fucking you over. So it has to be like every guy you see is working for the Juarez cartel who's linked up a new deal with Al-Qaeda. Like you would, you live in the middle of a fucking Clive Cussler novel, even though you've like nothing has ever happened to you, really.
Yeah.
And B, it's like this sort of obsession with rank. A lot of men do fantasize about going into the fucking military. Yep. Like, I know I did until I was, like, found drugs when I was 16. But it's because it's an appealing thing. It's like so much of life is so uncertain if you're that dislocated and that you're just degraded all the time. You feel humiliated all the time. You have to worry about these fucking basic things. And to have a rank over your fellow man that you're, you know, doing this with, and also that you're a troop, and that fucking Mexican piece of shit has to, you know, prove that he's not part of the conspiracy to, you know, turn your house into a fucking heroin cutting plant.
I see what you're saying, but imagine how degrading it is to have to call your childhood friend sir because he outranks you in this like weird militia group.
People also like that though too. Yeah. People do like answering to somebody sometimes, and
it's the Milhouse effect.
Yeah, the Milhouse effect, exactly.
So, something I think that is interesting that I've seen since Trump was elected is, and this isn't like super widespread, but I've see it more and more, that people on the left kind of saying like, oh, we need to get armed, or we need to get trained. There's like kind of a prepperism too, a little bit. Like
there's a little bit of like that the left needs its own gun culture.
I agree with that.
It's really similar to what happened in the right under Obama. But the thing is, you know, if you know, the conflict starts, civil war starts, and that's like I saw this like picture going around on Facebook of this guy that was like this kind of leftist guy that was like, you know, we need to start militias, and he was like, I'm carrying my shotgun. I was like, all right, you're already look like a joke. Nobody carries a fucking shotgun, you know. It's like these guys all have AR-15s, and they've been like, I mean, I think, you know, there's people asked when I was doing this thing, like, you know, is this like a shadow army or something? And it never was, because it's just there's too much infighting of the militia movement. And, you know, there's the idea of them ever throwing the government as a joke. But the risk is that, you know, we have all these people on the far right that have been doing paramilitary training above ground for years. Like they're really trained. And if there is real conflict, these guys are ready. You know, the left is not going to stand a chance against that kind of shit.
Start doing push-ups now.
Well, let me tell you a little bit about myself, Shane. I thought about being a Green Beret for two entire years when I was in high school. I just got back from the gym. So I have a 425-pound deadlift coming down from a peak of 500. And one more thing. I've been gaming for more than half my life.
See, I don't need any of that shit because I have every Jed Bartlett monologue memorized. You know, if any one of these toothless hayseeds comes at me with an AR-15, I'm going to shred them with logic.
Yeah, Matt's going to be like Patton with Rommel. You magnificent son of a bitch! You proved my point!
Well, I'll just say I'm agnostic on the larger question of a gun culture or left militia movement.
Guns like are fun. That's
yeah, they're fun.
Pretty cool.
Yeah, they are pretty cool.
Why not learn how to use them? That's all I'm saying.
Moving on from that, the last thing I want to talk to you about is like a bigger question now, like on sort of a global foreign policy level. I want to talk to you about Iran, because obviously you have a rather unique perspective on that country, and also forget everything, you know, the protests or whatever that's going on in this country with everything Trump's doing domestically. Man, it really seems like they are rattling that saber against the Islamic Republic.
Yeah. They're also, like, the funniest thing about this horrifying thing is, like, I guess someone told them last week that Russia and Iran have this long-standing strategic alliance. But they're trying to drive a wedge in between them, like Team Smoothbrain is trying to do it. Like, they're sending fucking Michael Flynn, one of the dumbest people alive, and his shitty son to, like, contact the Russian foreign ministry, like, dude, fucking Iran was talking shit about you, and we'll actually kick their ass.
You know, they're Muslims. You knew that, right?
Yeah, you knew
those guys were.
Yeah.
I know they're Shiites. That's different, like, whatever. But those are Muslims. What are you doing?
Interesting about the world right now and shitty is that, you know, like in the 30s there were all these authoritarians that were fighting each other, and now it's just this like authoritarian club where people are just like, yeah, I'm authoritarian, you're authoritarian, we're cool. You know, it's like, you know, Trump, Putin, Assad, like, you know. But then there's like this Iran problem that's kind of thrown in the mix, where it's like, actually, when you get a little bit deeper than that, like, it doesn't really work, you know, because these alliances are really complicated.
Yeah, and the American military establishment, they're not gonna, they have had their eye on Iran for a long time, you know, as enemies. And I just don't, I honestly don't, I mean, it's stupid to try to understand them, but like, he wants to be buddies with Putin, right? But he also wants to fuck up Iran. And like, maybe some person could figure out how to square that circle, but hell isn't him.
I can figure it out, actually. I do know a lot about Middle Eastern politics, but I'm not using that knowledge right now. Sometimes the side chick, they want to be the main thought. And currently, Iran is Russia's main thought. And I'm like, Trump is like, I can be, you know, like the bottom bitch. I can be like with Putin. I just have to put like I have to take away that side thought position from Iran.
He wants to be on Russia's Instagram.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like currently Putin and Trump, like Trump isn't tagged in the pictures when Putin is like, you know, like do VIP. But, you know, with Iran, they have like the selfie in bed. And
honestly, the only thing I could think of that would work is to say, hey, if, you know, we turn the Persian Gulf into a burning sea of, like, you know, burning oil tankers and sunken aircraft carriers, and, you know, Iran is a bombed out mess, oil prices are going to go through the roof, and that'll help your economy. Yeah. Like, that's all I could think of that could be a persuasive
argument.
Deal.
I mean,
no, but seriously, like Shane, like, they're okay, like probably the big Obama foreign policy achievement was the Iran deal.
Yeah,
that's probably going to get put through the fucking shredder like now, basically. I mean, what was your perspective on the Iran deal and then where we're at now?
I mean, I think that the Iran deal was, I think that was a pretty good achievement, actually. I mean, you know, when I was in prison, I was like, make this shit happen a little more fast, please. And I was pretty frustrated with the pace of things. But, you know, I think it was one of the few foreign policy successes of of the Obama administration. But, you know, there's so many things like this of, you know, it's similar with the private prison question, which I wrote about a lot, where, like, the Department of Justice decided they're not going to use private prisons anymore. The private prison companies' stocks tanked. And then Trump was elected, and that day it just went through the roof. And it's like, he hasn't announced that he's, like, you know, going to keep those contracts, but he will. You know, it's like all that stuff that took forever to do is just, like, totally wiped out, you know. And Iran definitely feels like that. And that's a hard thing to roll back from, you know, when the U.S. administration changes and we're just back into this, like, mode that we were in, what, like 8 or 10 years ago, you know. That was a hard thing to repair. Not that it was really fully repaired, but it was like a little step.
I mean, I know you probably don't want to, you're not probably wishing to go to war with Iran or anything, but what if we could just, like, kick a few of them in the nuts? A few specific? I mean, would you personally like that, Shane?
I have a few, yeah.
Or just like, you know, like
I actually,
a pistol that shoots a boxing glove.
Yeah. I think I had those dreams for a long time after I got in prison.
Yeah. Like, what do you think Iran thinks? Like, I mean, it's hard to like, you know, can you like put yourself in their shoes? Like, what do you think that they like? How do they look at America or like in a Trump administration?
I mean, who knows? I mean, the Iranian government is really complex and it fights itself a lot. And I think that's the main like thing that the U.S. does not understand and doesn't. The media definitely doesn't really hit that level. I mean, you know, even when I was in prison, it was kind of like the story was like, what does Iran want to get from holding us? But like, in reality, inside Iran, they were fighting with each other about what to do with us. And it was, there were all these power plays that were happening. And I remember after I got out, we did this little tour of DC and I met Hillary Clinton once and she was like, Iran, they're just like, you know, they're done. They're fighting with themselves. They're tearing each other apart, which is exactly the same story that you see on Iranian TV about the US.
He was like, Shane, you may not be Leonard Skinner, but how does it feel to be free as a bird?
Now, the principalist faction may not be 3-6 Mafia, but they are tearing this club up.
We basically have an hour, though. Okay. Well, then.
That's a rush you.
Yeah, no, I mean. Do you guys have anything else for Shane?
I had a couple questions about the article, just two questions. And one was, did you, hanging out with those guys in the desert, you know, doing the things they were doing, there was a thrill to it you talked about, mm-hmm. you copped to.
Yeah.
Did you become at all paranoid throughout it? Did any of this wear off on you?
You know, the thing that paranoid me the most was the prep work for that story, which involved listening to Alex Jones every day. And at some point, I was like, I need to stop this. Cause it's like 3 or 4 hours every day. And he's just screaming into my ear over and over. And it's not that I believed what he was saying. I was just like, holy shit, the country is falling apart.
Hold on a minute, though. You've not seen the gay frogs?
Actually, you mentioned their paranoia and your paranoia doing this. The other detail, you joined this movement with your real name?
Yeah.
What I mean, bad obstacle. Like, on their part, that they wouldn't just, like, look you up.
No, I mean...
Doing this work,
that story and the prison story. I mean, I never lie when I'm doing this stuff. It's kind of, like, a rule. So, it's really showed me how little people use Google, you know? People... I mean, and especially with...
Just, like Shane Bauer, you know, has a byline at, like, a liberal Jew magazine. Yeah.
I think those militia guys are probably still rocking like Ask Jeeves.
Yeah. They're not even using the search engine Ask Jeeves. They're asking the guy from Twitter, Jeeves.
There was one time actually on Facebook that somebody, I was just like, I was casting the net wide and just like trying to get involved in any militia I could. And there was like a little militia startup in California that was like a brand trying to get going. And it was like, who's down? And I was like, I'm down. And somebody like posted under mine. It was like, this guy's a reporter and linked to something. And I was like, oh shit, what do I do? And I just like basically just deleted my comment. So it erased his and it was like, fine. That was the only time. But there's like, you know, probably hundreds of people that like saw my name in that world and know that was
you
the only guy that checked.
Sent a chill down my spine by saying a malicious startup, because now I'm imagining Silicon Valley deciding to secede.
No, we trained once the California State Militia. I went on a training in Menlo Park, like right across from Facebook. Yeah. It was so weird. It was like these guys in camo, like running around. Half of them were passing out because they had walked like 200 feet.
Oh,
and then there's like these white ladies pushing those exercise strollers. You know?
So awesome.
And Shane, my second question is, you know, after you left the militia and then you contacted some of the guys to see if they wanted to mm-hmm. do a follow-up interview, and then the article came out, what were their reactions to it? Do people hate you? Are you on the murder list now?
It was interesting. I was a little nervous about that. You know, I was like trying to make sure my address wasn't online and stuff like that, and I watched Facebook. Some of them unfriended me, so I didn't see what they were saying. But
fake friends. Yeah. Fake friends.
They immediately posted a meme from real life bad guy.
But a surprising number of people, either that I had met doing it or that I hadn't met, they were just in the scene, liked it. They were kind of like, yeah, that's pretty, you know, accurate. and fair. And so I think some of them felt like they looked like badasses.
It was a humanizing depiction, I felt.
Yeah.
Yeah, and absolutely. I mean, like, and like the way like you give due to their own self image. Like you're not just gonna be like calling them like, oh, these racist yahoos playing with guns on the border, which, let's be honest, they kind of are. But
yeah, but you're just letting them speak for themselves.
Yeah, you have to credit like someone's own self-perception, yeah, for sure.
That was another thing I noticed with the private prison piece that I wish we got to talk about a little bit was, I mean, with the militia, yeah, that's one thing. They're a bunch of assholes in the desert who, like, don't use Google. But, like, you apply to this, like, this private prison company that makes a shitload of money and has a whole apparatus around it. And they also didn't. They were like, "Oh, that's weird that a reporter from Leather Jones is becoming a fucking prison guard."
I guess that journalism game isn't what it used to be.
Everyone's got a side gig now.
Yeah. It's the gig economy.
Yeah, we're all hustling.
Well, Shane, I want to say thanks so much for talking to us and. Congratulations on winning the Oscar for Best Magazine. No, but seriously, though, you do incredible work, and I just, like, I can't wait to read you in the future, and, like, really good stuff, and it was great talking to you, man.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks.
Thank you.
Pleasure. Thanks for joining us, man.